Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello!
Welcome to the special pre-Shrove Tuesday.
Oh, I'm quite excited about Shrove Tuesday.
You are you?
Yeah. You're quite surprised, aren't you? I've sort of thrown you a googly.
You have thrown me a googly.
I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm quite a mean pancake maker.
This is surprising to me.
It is surprising. I've made pancakes for my children for a number of years now, and generally to rave reviews.
There is a level of physical adeptness to tossing a pancake.
No,
up
the tossing
the air
is really
okay,
difficult.
Okay, right.
No. The tossing is like, you can just imagine. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it kind of gets all mushed up, and then it's sort of, you know, that it's not really a pancake, it's a sort of bit of kind of dough, sort of, you know, fried dough. I mean, it's sort of, no, but as long as I've got a sort of spatula and I can sort of just ease it over, generally, and my children are quite understanding if it comes out sort of misshapen or whatever. It's been on the podcast before, but when we bought this new frying pan, things have improved tremendously.
It was a life changer.
It's definitely changed in relation to the pancakes. I noticed it was a bit scratched the other day. I was kind of nearly engaged in a domestic row because I'm quite careful about not scratching it.
You want to be careful. Is it a non-stick?
Yeah.
You want to be careful about eating off a non-stick
really?
Pan with a scratch in it. Yeah, really? I think it, you know,
poisonous.
I think a little bit, yeah.
It's only a little scratch.
Oh, it'll be fine. I don't know anything about frying pans.
Is that really a thing?
I think it's a thing.
Maybe I should make pancakes for you one day.
Well, maybe you should. Maybe we should make a video of how to make pancakes, the Miliband method.
Good idea.
Yeah.
You're on.
We could do it in one of your two kitchens.
Yeah, excellent. that's a good idea. No, so I'm an enthusiast for Shrove Tuesday.
I was going to mention our walking episode from a couple of weeks ago. I have still been obsessively walking since then. The other day, I was looking at my phone and I'd got up to over 25,000 steps in a day and I was aiming for 30,000. Then guess what happened?
I don't know.
The battery on my phone went flat.
Yeah, I think you sent it to me. I mean,
I just got on the bus and came home because it doesn't count if your phone isn't counting yet.
I mean, there's quite a lot of humble brag or not so humble brag going on.
Look, I don't have a lot to brag about in life generally.
Well, I already felt sort of outdone by you. When it came to the walking. And now you've sort of outdone me further.
But there aren't many areas in my life where my accomplishments better yours, though. Can you not just let me have that?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I can.
You're so competitive.
I can.
Should we move on to what we're talking about this week?
Well, this week, Jeff, we're talking about masculinity. We're going to be exploring society's expectations of men and masculinity. And we're talking to organisations which are trying to reshape expectations of men and promoting positive expressions of masculinity. I mean, this has got really obviously broad relevance to everybody, but it's also, you know, there's a particular aspect to this, which is that men are responsible for more than 3/4 of violent crime and make up 95% of the prison population. Men are 3 times as likely to die by suicide than women, and suicide is the biggest killer of men under 45. We need to be talking about these issues, and we're going to be speaking to Iman Amrani, a Guardian journalist who's made a great video series exploring some of these themes, and Ben Hurst, who runs workshops for men with a group called the Good Lad Initiative. And then we're talking to Nathan Roberts from A Band of Brothers, a charity providing positive role models for men involved in the criminal justice system. And they're trying to sort of reinvent the kind of, I guess, this sort of initiation rites for men. I mean, that sounds a bit off-putting, but I think that's what their weekends and their
process is. And it's quite mysterious,
about.
Isn't it?
It's quite mysterious, deliberately, because I think, you know, their theory is if they told people in advance what these weekends involve, lots of people wouldn't go. And so I think they keep it a bit mysterious. But it's a really interesting conversation with him.
And I think that the whole episode is going to be an interesting one, because talking about men's issues in a way that doesn't feel like it belongs to the so-called men's rights activists, the Piers Morgans of this world, the people who say, why isn't there an International Men's Day? There is. Have you seen Richard Herring every year on International Women's Day? He searches Twitter for people saying, so why isn't there a men's day? He just replies to them, there is, and then gives them the date of it. Like thousands of that. And he raises money for a women's charity as well in the process. It's an incredible thing. But yeah, this conversation often is hijacked by the Piers Morgans and Jordan Petersons of the world.
We need to reclaim International Men's Day. I mean, I think there is people are starting to do that, aren't they? It's the 19th of November, by the way.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that, you best bear with me here, that when I was a child, my father used to tell me a story about two sheep who lived on the Yorkshire moors called Boo Boo and Hee Hee. I loved the stories that he used to tell me. And there were the sort of big giant and some kind of guy called Jonathan Pillowcase. And anyway, it was quite a sort of brilliant story. And I used to love the stories. And I've been telling my kids this story as well.
Is it from a book or is it of your father's invention?
No, we just made it up. We lived in Leeds when I was between the age of 3 and 7. Yeah. 3 and 7. And so it was sort of the Yorkshire Moors and all that. So I've been telling this story to my kids since they were young, and they really liked the story. And it's kind of become sort of embroidered, and there's quite a lot sort of to it. Anyway, I've sort of got to the stage where I'm thinking, oh God, they're going to sort of like, they're kind of getting to the age where they're going to be like, we don't really want any Boo Boo and Hee Hee tonight. Thanks very much. We're too busy sort of, I don't know, whatever. Not only is Boo Boo and Hee Hee sort of, it was sort of in abeyance for a bit, it seems to have been resurrected, but also my dad was a writer of books about sort of politics and, class and society, but he once started writing a book of this. Anyway, and I found my kids at the computer the other morning and they were starting to write the book. So there you go.
So it's like a passing down the generations, passed from one generation to the next.
Yeah.
Wow. I think this should be shared with the world.
Definitely.
It's good. That's so exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting.
Maybe you could record as a special episode where you tell us the story of Boo Boo and Hee Hee.
Maybe. Could be a bonus episode.
Yeah, because sometimes if Sarah's away, I can't sleep, and I try and find a podcast that has a soporific quality to it.
Yeah.
That could be a big market.
Yeah.
In this. I mean, not that, it would have wanted Boo Boo and Hee Hee commercialised.
The chief magician is called Amanda Chairleg.
Right.
She's a kind of big kind of
what
character.
I love is we're really seeing your dad's brain at work as he looks around the room.
Well, no, Amanda Chairleg is mine, actually.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah.
She's in the kind of sequel,
Right.
My sequel.
Right.
Anyway, so that's my reason to be cheerful. What's yours?
Mine was I took my son to get his feet measured at Clark's Shoes.
Right.
And I just got this Proustian rush. What a great thing to do. Do you not remember going and having your feet measured as a kid? Was this not do you not have fond memories of having your feet measured?
Not really?
Maybe it's just me then. But I loved seeing them get that contraption out. I really wanted them to do me, but I think it might have been...
Well, I always find going to buy them shoes an absolute pain in the arse, to be honest.
Oh, really? I quite like just getting to see the foot measuring machine as well.
Do you? You like the foot measuring machine?
Yeah, I do. Although I wear size 8 shoes.
Right.
But I think my feet are actually substantially smaller than that.
Right.
I think they're just very, very wide, like a hobbit's foot.
Mm. I have quite flat feet, actually.
Would you put a character called Jeff Hobbitfoot into Hee Hee and Boo Boo?
Boo Boo, definitely.
Does it have to be that way around?
Definitely.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We have with us now in the attic Iman Amrani, who is Guardian journalist and host of the Modern Masculinity video series, and Ben Hurst, who is head of facilitation and training at the Good Lad Initiative. Hello, both.
Hi.
Hey, hello. Hey.
We start with you, Iman. Can you tell us about the inspiration for the Modern Masculinity series and the question that you start with, which is masculinity in crisis?
Well, yeah, I started working at The Guardian about 6 years ago, and most of the stories that I did were around terrorism, knife crime, football, and areas of culture which were dominated by men. And so I've always been interested in those kinds of spaces. But I think something really happened after the Me Too movement, where I felt that loads of the conversation my friends were having, my guy friends, weren't actually happening in a public space or in the mainstream. And there were lots of really interesting questions to look into about how they were feeling. And I thought that The Guardian would be quite a good platform that could be used to kind of explore some of those questions in a non-judgmental way. So I went off and started looking at things like the rise of Jordan Peterson and, you know, male role models, and spoke to loads of different men about what they see masculinity as being in the modern day.
Give us your big sort of takeout conclusions about the crisis of masculinity. Kind of, you know, what's your sort of assessment? What needs to happen?
I feel like when I've gone and looked at different areas around masculinity, I've gone to spaces where there are loads of men. Jordan Peterson's one of those things. Another place I went to was UFC. I went to New York and went to a fight at Madison Square Garden. And
this is cage fighting type thing.
Yeah, they don't like to call it cage fighting, but it is in a cage. Yeah. And so
and it is fighting.
And it is fighting, yes. They call it the octagon.
Right.
And so I went along to that, and you know, there's loads of working class people there, and there are loads of immigrants there. And the biggest fighters are, you know, Latinos. There's lots of black fighters as well. And that space has kind of been co-opted to some degree by the right. And Donald Trump turned up at the event that I was at. And I thought, this is so interesting. This is a space where there are all of these guys who you traditionally kind of associate as like voters on the left, you know. And these are people who are, you know, they should be engaging with, I guess, the ideas of the Democrat Party, if we're going to look at that. But actually, you know, Trump had taken control of that space. And I was like, it's really interesting. I feel like the left don't know how to engage with these male-dominated spaces. The same thing, I did an episode about circumcision. And there's this whole movement trying to end circumcision for men. And they're called intactivists. And on the sharp end of that, you've got these kind of alt-right guys who use this fight against circumcision against Jewish communities and Muslim communities. And I was like, I go into all these spaces that, you know, we're talking about bodily autonomy if we're talking about circumcision. We're talking about, you know, like working class people and immigrants if we're talking about UFC. And then we're talking about lost people looking for meaning. These are spaces that should be open to the left. And for some reason, the right's come in and just taken up that ground. And I find that is one of the interesting things in the series that I find is that we don't know on the left how to talk about men in a sympathetic way.
How interesting. Ben, tell us about the Good Lad Initiative and how you got involved in it and what it does.
Okay, so Good Lad is an organisation that works, a gender equality organisation that works with men and boys, engaging them in conversations which are essentially deconstructing and reconstructing masculinity. So we work in schools, in universities, in corporate spaces, and anywhere that anybody wants us to work. And we basically just have conversations with men. Essentially, we give people space to explore what they think masculinity is, how they feel about it.
On university campuses?
Yeah, so on university campuses, in schools, in corporate spaces.
Right. And are you pushing, is the wrong word, are you sort of modelling, showing people a particular version of masculinity or?
No. So I think one of the things that's hard about this kind of work is that, I think we problematize masculinity in a really unhelpful way sometimes. And I don't think the problem is actually with masculinity. I think the problem is with patriarchy and a system that prioritizes men and gives men power. And that power will ultimately corrupt whatever you give it to, right? So masculinity as a social construct, arguably as a social construct, has evolved and changed over time. And it evolves and changes wherever we are in the world or whatever time we're in, right? So if you go to, I think one of the things we talk about with masculinity is men's relationship to women. But if you look at men in an environment where there are no women, so you go to a prison, for example, masculinity can still be very harmful in that space, right? Because it's still about power and how that power is wielded and how we manipulate it and what we do with it. So I think being prescriptive about masculinity isn't really the answer. Like giving, saying this version of masculinity is wrong and now we should all be like this is still going to be corrupted. If we tell men that they need to be kind and they need to be gentle, that will become manipulation, right? So I think it's about problematizing the system and being able to give people the lens to see what that is and how it operates, and then allowing them to opt in or opt out of that where they feel it's necessary.
I think that's a really good point to make, actually. That thing, when we talk, so often when we talk about masculinity, it's like there are, you know, two or three main scripts that you can go on. And so when you talk about, I in the series never talk about toxic masculinity. I don't use the phrase, partially because I think it's a bit of a term that, you know, people that haven't been to university and aren't using kind of academic language right. around gender, it's just not, it's not how people speak, and it derails the conversation if you take it there. But also, I just feel like a lot of the time people are saying, okay, we've got this toxic masculinity and we need to pull it back and let men be vulnerable and in touch with their emotions. Right. But it's almost like from one extreme to another. And there's no kind of middle ground where you can be like, okay, we want to break away from this really kind of rigid idea. And I feel like that was a big important thing with this series was, okay, let's go and talk to like loads of different guys and have lots of different, you know, experiences and approaches to masculinity. But it's very difficult to get that anywhere, because it just feels like, even when you see, I think that's why the Gillette advert did so badly last year, because it was like,
us about the Gillette advert.
So the Gillette advert that went out, it came off the back of the whole Me Too movement, and they were kind of trying to jump on that bandwagon, and they did this whole thing of I think it was from the best a man can get to the best a man can be or something, and it was all about men standing up, you know, for women, but it was very kind of performative and didn't feel very authentic, and it felt quite accusatory against like all men, and yeah. I was like, that's not the best way of having this conversation, because it puts people in a very defensive position. It's like an us and them, right. and good and bad and black and white, and I don't think you can approach masculinity like that, just like you can't approach women and femininity like that. It's not one, you know, it's not, like I say, it's not one size fits all. So I just feel like that is a point that you've raised that I think very often we'd overlook.
We skip, right? Yeah. And I think that what was interesting about the Gillette advert as well was that a lot of men were upset, but it was a very specific demographic of men who were upset, right? It was very working class white males who were really pissed off about, like, by this advert, like outraged. But masculinity, and I think that was because the advert looked at that specific type of masculinity. So it was looking at things like barbecuing. It was looking at things like kids fighting in the garden and saying, this is wrong, we shouldn't be doing this as men. But those things also look very different from community to community and from demographic to demographic, right? Masculinity for black men is very different to masculinity for South Asian men. Also very similar in lots of different ways. Masculinity for a disabled man is very different to masculinity for an able-bodied man. And it just continues. Like, the more you put identity in the mix, is the, I think that's probably the reason as an organisation we don't have a hard line on what the conversation should be.
And what comes out of the good line, when, you know, think about the before and after of the Good Lad Initiative, when people come in, how are they different after it, would you say?
So I think what we do is we start a conversation. I think when you're doing that as a project, it's very hard to measure the outcomes. Yeah. But what we often see is people come in and leave thinking differently, or at least leave with the ability to critique, right? Which I think is a skill that the majority of us aren't really taught very well, how to critically analyze any piece of information. And so when you give people that space to do that, they're then able to think, oh, I don't know if I actually like that thing, or how is that perpetuated, or why does that exist? Where does that come from? And once you give people the tools to do that, then they begin to make their own changes that they feel like they want to make.
Just tying in with what you said earlier about leaving this, to the left, and what not the left, sorry, leaving it to the right, and what Ben said about not having a model of this. I mean, maybe there's something in this, isn't there, which is sort of, I'm not going to express this very well, but sort of the left and sort of speaking to these issues.
Yeah, I think people just find it hard to find their footing in that, because so much, I think, you know, I work at The Guardian, like I am on the left, right? And I just think there's often these scripts that we have when it comes to looking at all these different areas, when it comes to identity and politics. Yeah. And when it comes to men, people find it hard because they think that you're either pro-men or pro-women. It's like a binary thing all the time, right? And you've got to say everything just the right way so people are scared to say anything. And that means it's really hard to have a conversation about men that's honest, because sometimes things are going to get said that are uncomfortable. Because if you don't open that conversation up, you don't... I mean, Jay-Z said one time on an interview, what you reveal, you heal, right? So when you have that conversation and you talk about something uncomfortable, really and honestly, you can actually do something about it. And if you don't, someone will take that space from you and have a different conversation, which might have much more kind of scary effect.
And just to push back, given that there is this sort of, you don't use the phrase toxic masculinity, but there is this sort of dominant culture view of men, sort of macho, aggressive, and so on. How do we change that without being judgmental?
One of the things that we do is when we open up these spaces, we work in men, male-only spaces, right?
Yeah.
So people who identify as men come into space, have the conversation. And I think we lay down some ground rules, so we'll start a conversation by maybe exploring what comfort and discomfort look like and feel like in our bodies and how we talk about that in this space. And I think... the thing that is hard is, like you just said, like people feel policed in their language. They feel policed in what they are allowed to say and not allowed to say. They feel like there are right and wrong answers. And in some cases, there are. Like, in some cases, there are objectively things that are correct and incorrect. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that people don't think the wrong thing, right? It doesn't mean that people don't think things that are harmful.
Right.
And them not speaking about those things is not a helpful environment for them to be in. So I think a lot of that in my job is facilitating a space where people can be open and honest and we are genuinely exploring. I feel like a lot of that, when we use the word exploration, a lot of the time we're actually talking about teaching. So we're actually talking about telling people the correct answer in a way that feels like we're not telling them something. But actually, I think it's about giving people space to problematize whatever it is that they want. And I feel like when you present all of the options in that way, people will arrive, more often than not, people will arrive at correct conclusions or healthy conclusions. Because I don't think that the majority of men are out here trying to be horrible people or really want to like the statistics are bad, right? Like male suicide is the lead killer of men under 55 in the UK. So when you present someone with that as an idea, most people will not want to opt into it. So most people automatically move into how do we change that? But I think it's just about actually creating space for people to really grapple with those ideas.
I mean, there's an element to this, isn't there, that we sort of talk about these models of men as sort of oppressing women, which they do, but they also oppress men.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we need to talk, and you mentioned the issues of suicide. Mm-hmm. Do say something about that and your perspectives.
What is important here, or the way that I would frame this message, is that patriarchy as a construct is also shit for men.
Yeah.
It benefits men, right? Yeah. It is built to benefit men. So it does do that. Also very specific types of men. So if you are winning in the game of masculinity, then you will be benefiting majorly from patriarchy. But even when you benefit in that way, we still live within a system that means that what that benefit looks like is actually like a decreased life expectancy, or it looks like you being suffering with mental health issues or being under too much stress or whatever. So if you are somebody who's able to climb up to the top and you get to be the CEO of the company, that's not a particularly desirable position for a man to be in, particularly when men are more likely to engage in risk-taking behavior, right? Or more likely to engage in substance abuse or whatever it might be.
As a CEO of the Labour Party, I can definitely vouch for that.
Right. And that's a good position to be in, right? You're winning in the game, but it's also not necessarily the healthiest thing for you as an individual man. And so I think that is important. And I think that conversation has to be held in tension with the reality of what that looks like for people who are not men. So at the same time as it being shit for men, which it is, it's also disproportionately bad for everyone else.
Yeah.
Like other people are actually being oppressed,
like
right? Yeah, like women are being oppressed. So we can't have one conversation without having the other conversation, but we can have both conversations at the same time. And we can create space for both conversations at the same time, I think.
I think it's also, I do agree with what you're saying, but I do think you can look at the masculinity thing in isolation. We kind of need to do that, because every time I speak to people outside at work about what I'm doing, they do say to me, oh yeah, I've watched your series on toxic masculinity. And I'm like, I never use that word. Mm. So something's gone into your head where you hear the word masculinity and you think toxic.
Is that bad though?
Yeah, because it means that you, before you've engaged with somebody or something, you've decided that it's toxic. The fact is that they put a word which is completely unrelated, which just goes to show that we have taken that on board and kind of without even really challenging it or thinking about it, we've absorbed it and we put it out there. And I think that if I say to have a conversation, you have to come to it open-minded. Mm-hmm. If you're coming into it thinking it's already toxic, that's not open-minded.
But there are some things, I'm sorry to sound like the sort of, well, I'm not sorry, but I mean, there are some things that aren't good, right?
Yeah, and those things, when we decide what they are and when we talk about them and give them a name, we can then call them toxic. And if we can't separate things and look at them critically for what they actually are, and we're just broadly thinking, you know, that's when you get the men saying, not all men. And I go, actually, that's a fair point now, because you've just been labelled. You could be doing the best you could.
The men say what?
Not all men. You know, not all men. It's like something gets said about men generally, and that's a response. And it turned into this ridiculous argument, especially on social media. And you'll have a guy jump in and aggressively be like, not all men. And I think, actually, I can see why you're getting annoyed now, because no matter what you do, it might be really positive. People end up coming to it and thinking that it's a bad thing because it's about men. And I think that if you're going to have a conversation that's progressive and that's going to have solutions and is going to take you somewhere, you have to allow for there to be something positive in masculinity, and that you don't automatically kind of taint it with that negative brush immediately, because you just, like I say, these are how you shut conversations.
I mean, that is true, isn't it? But our society is structured in a way that, okay, I mean, maybe it's not all men, but even the most, I don't know whether you like the word woke is the right phrase, this word to use here, even the most woke men are operating in a very patriarchal society.
Structurally.
I mean, okay, I get that, right? And I actually think sometimes woke men are the worst men, because they're actually being quite performative. They tell you they're a feminist, but they're actually trying to win points with women, and there's a lot going on there, right? I think that I come from a background which is a very, very kind of machista background. Like, my dad's Algerian, he's North African. I grew up in a Muslim community where girls and boys were separated at Islamic school. You know, we were treated very differently. And so I really, really believe in equality, and I believe in kind of pushing to have that kind of balance of power between men and women. Yeah. And I think that whilst it's true that there are issues, my point is that it's one thing pointing them out, but it's another thing thinking, okay, so how can we solve that? And I think the approach is so important. I'm not denying that there are massive issues, but I just think in order to have a conversation that's going to go anywhere, you have to come to it and be ready for there to be something positive as well.
Ben?
Yeah, I think, I guess...
You only heal what you reveal.
You only hear what you reveal, and
I'm no Jay-Z.
Well, don't say that about yourself. You're doing a good job. I think that there is probably something in here about masculinity. Like, we don't, in our work, we don't use the phrase toxic masculinity either. It was really interesting. I did a TED talk, and the responses in the comments, a lot of the responses to the TED talk were like, here's another soy boy talking about toxic masculinity. That's not part of the conversation that I'm trying to have, really. And I think if anything, it's toxic again, it's patriarchy rather than masculinity. I do think in my experience, when I've been in rooms full of men and I've asked men to list or label things that are positive about masculinity, that's a really hard question to answer. I don't know. Like, I do believe there are good things about masculinity.
What are the positive things about masculinity?
Well, I think again...
Name one good thing each.
Strength, I would say, is a good thing about masculinity. But strength is easily corrupted, right? So I think to have that conversation about positive masculinity...
Strength means what?
I don't know. It could be mental strength. It could be physical strength. It could be dominance. It could be power. It could be whatever. But I think any of those things are not inherently bad things, right? Like, they are necessary things to exist in the world. People need to be strong. It's a part of life. That's very, very easily corrupted. But the problem for me is that is not corrupted by masculinity. It's not corrupted by men. It's corrupted by a system that says, this is what we value. And so for you to succeed, you need to be this thing. And in our society, men are the people that need to succeed. We don't really need to worry about women in that way. And so I think it's hard then to have that conversation. You wanted to add something.
These things can be applied to men and women,
right.
But I would say also things like protection, you know, like I'm really conscious of how small I am and it's associated with me being a woman. And there's things where I've been with guys and they've made me feel, you know, safer, or there's been guys at work who've been really kind of you know, positive, and just I can't really explain it, you know, in a family structure you'll look at like the uncles and you'll look at the aunties and they have slightly different roles, and I'd look at the uncles for some my uncles for some things and be like, you know, you make me feel quite safe, and I'd look at my aunties for other things, and yeah, it could cross over and they could decide they want to do different things, but there's what something which is more associated with masculinity, that is protection, and there's something to, you know, associated with kind of nurturing, which is associated with femininity. And you can decide you want to have more or less of either one as a man or a woman, but I don't think those are bad things.
I think
we need more nurturing men though, don't we?
And the issue here is probably that it's limiting, right? So there's
exactly.
there is something that says, as a man, you are supposed to be this thing and you are not supposed to be
exactly.
this thing. As a woman, you're supposed to be this and you're not supposed to be that. And actually, there are loads of us who want to be both or want to be the opposite of what it is that people are telling us we're supposed to be. And I think that leads to a lot of issues also. So I think
my wife is very good at trying to get our boys to talk about their feelings because I can tell. I mean, I don't have daughters, so I just don't know. But I think it is much harder in the culture for boys to talk about their feelings, right. feel, you know, emotional. I also think
that they need to have tools with which to do that, and things like the more traditional things like sports. You know, I work. I actually went this week to Football Beyond Borders. It's a football charity, and I did an episode with them in the series, and I worked with them a lot. This week they had an event, and the whole thing, they had loads of things about masculinity, and their young kids, they use football, which is seen as a very kind of masculine space, and they have these classroom sessions with the kids. The kids come for the hour of football, they get to play afterwards, and in the classroom sessions they talk about role models, they use the footballers, and they kind of use that as a way of getting
the kids
to talk. Exactly, it's so good what they do, and they use that as a way of getting in, but it's understanding how they think, as you know, there are girls there as well, but it's mostly guys at the moment, and understanding what gets the guys going, what they're interested in, and how to clock into that. And then the kids don't even realize they're talking about their feelings because they're talking about football. And so, you know, you have to kind of have an awareness and an understanding of how these young boys think and how they're conditioned, and then be able to be kind of, it's like a soft touch. And I think that that's the way that you have this conversation.
I think when my son's old enough, we're going to have to be teaching him to talk about his feelings less. Just keep bottle them up a bit more.
Does he talk a lot about his feelings?
I'm always talking about my... I think my wife would rather I didn't talk about my feelings so much. I think she'd just save the tears for something significant, not Mamma Mia 2.
You're a good advert for a positive masculinity.
I don't know. I feel very inadequate when I think of myself in any way.
Who do you think you look at as a man and you think...
Ed.
No, don't do that. Oh, that was such a cop-out.
Go on.
Who do you look at as a man and think, like, that's somebody that I really respect? I think it's such an interesting question to ask men.
No one in the public sphere, I don't think. I look at my family, I look at the men in my family and I think, oh, there are, but I feel like to respect someone in that way, you have to know them.
I mean, yeah, I guess it's down to interpretation, but who would you say then?
My dad?
Your dad.
Yeah.
And what do you respect about your dad?
Well, so my dad's an interesting one because my dad in a lot of ways is the things that we talk about, right? Or the things that I talk about at work. So he's not emotionally literate. He doesn't talk about his feelings ever. I think I've seen him take 3 days off of work in his life, off of sick. And he doesn't necessarily model a lot of those things, but then I see him being a provider and I see him being very, very nurturing or very caring when people are sick. He looks after people. He does cooking. He does cleaning. He does things around the house. He splits housework equally with my mom, and he does, like, I feel like there are really good characteristics that I look at him and I think, oh, when I'm an adult, or I'm an adult now, but I think if I ever have a family and children, I would like to model some of those things. And then there are some things I'd like to change.
I'm struggling.
It's a hard question to answer.
I'm really struggling.
Wow.
Are you struggling?
No, I can think of friends of mine.
I'm talking with a public figure.
Yeah, because I don't think of public figures in that way. Because I only
friend.
Know, like,
you could say a friend and just say what it was that you respected about them. Even then, do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
And when you think of somebody, like, what are the things that you would say, I respect them because, I don't know, is it because they're loyal or is it because they are, you know, brave and they will stand up for what they believe in? Or
but I've got a friend I'm thinking of who's sort of very much like that. He, you know, he's really sort of principled and loyal and will speak up. But I've never particularly sort of thought about those things in terms of his masculinity.
I would say it's not a cop-out. I would say Jeff.
Seriously. Why?
Because I think you're very generous, sort of caring for other people. You've got very, very high EQ. You kind of very, very quick to detect if people aren't very happy or upset or feeling worried about something.
Those are really good reasons. I like those reasons.
So we're always looking to give people something to take away from the podcast. Like, what is something people can take away from this, maybe go away and do or think about or even join in with?
One of the things that kind of sticks with me from this series was a guy called Neil, who I spoke to in the second episode, and he said that he had a value system that he believed in, but he wasn't living in accordance with that. And it wasn't until he kind of had a breakup and kind of came into this realization that he wasn't the man that he thought he should be. And that, at that point, everything kind of changed for him. And that really resonated with me. And I just think there's something in thinking about who it is that you actually want to be and not feeling like that has to fit into a script that is set by somebody else or somebody else telling you who you should be. And part of that's just surrounding yourself with really, really good people. That's what this series has done for me.
But I mean, that is so important because there's so much pressure not to do that. That is really important, Ben.
Yeah, I would say, do you know, there was an interesting thing when we were having this conversation just now about which men we look up to and respect. I would hazard a guess at maybe men not being socialized to look up to other men. And I don't know if that's, I think when you're a child, you look up to like footballers or whatever it might be, athletes in particular.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we look at other men in terms of their characters and aspire to be that. I think we look at them in terms of position and aspire to be where they are. So maybe that's a good thing to take away from the podcast, is to go away and think about some men in your life, particularly if you're a man, who you look at and you respect and why you respect them. And I would say, I think conversations are another really important part of this. And it sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but actually that is the space where transformation happens. In my mind, that's where you see things change, you hear different opinions, you're challenged, you're stretched, and you're allowed to consider and imagine different things. And I think that's a big piece of this, is allowing people the space to imagine things that are different than what we can see. So I'd say have conversations about it. Talk to your fathers, talk to your brothers, talk to your sons, talk to whoever wants to talk about it, talk to your friends, and just see what happens, see what comes out of the conversation.
When you reveal.
Yeah.
You heal. Sorry, I took you.
Very good.
He was like, you go? No, you go.
Ben and Iman, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you very thank much. You.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On the line now, we have Nathan Roberts, who is co-founder and chief executive of A Band of Brothers. Hello.
Hello.
Do you want to start by telling us what A Band of Brothers is and what is the story of how it came about?
Yeah, if we go back in time and look at how communities used to organise themselves and how societies used to work, there was a time when the community would recognise that young men were starting to really get into their power, and that there was a real need for those communities to ensure that those young men channeled that power into what we might now call pro-social means that would enable that power to be used by the community for the good of the community. And so communities invested a huge amount of resources in the men, older men of that community, taking those young men away on a rite of passage, on an initiatory process that effectively formed a social contract and said to the young men, okay, if you want to call yourself a man around here, this is what it looks like. This is what it takes. This is what it means to be a man around here. And once you are a man around here, here's what you can count on from us. So there was this creation of an intergenerational contract between older and younger men. And when we were looking around at a group of men who were concerned about society and what we saw was going on, we believe that that intergenerational contract had been lost. And so we stepped up as a bunch of men who were active, who'd done some men's work, who'd seen the power and experienced the power of a men's group, and decided that we would like to try and extend ourselves in service to a group of men in society that we saw were really struggling. And those were young men, often care leavers, who were in contact with the criminal justice system. And we thought, what would it look like if we tried to do something about that issue?
And what did it look like? What did you try to do?
So we went out and we offered those young men the call to adventure. And we said, look, we are here to offer you a space to really explore and investigate what type of man you want to be. Do you fancy that? And the inevitable question came of, well, what's going to happen? And we said, we're not going to tell you. The only way to find out is to step in.
And you do these weekends. Is mainly about these quest weekends. Is that right?
That's right. So when we sort of look back through history, some of the initiation rituals and rites that in times gone by are no longer appropriate. So in certain tribes, there would be the idea that you had to go off and kill a lion. And obviously, we're quite short of lions in the UK.
And you don't want to kill them if you have some anyway.
And we wouldn't want to kill them. No. And there's almost inevitably health and safety implications of that. So so what we did was construct a modern-day mythopoetic ritual for these young men to take part in. So we give people the choice to cross a threshold, to take a step into an altered kind of space. So no business as usual. That's the most important thing. No business as usual. Mobile phones go in a bag and you don't get them back from until 3 p.m. on the Sunday. And we are spending time absolutely present with each person. We have two staff members for every one initiate to ensure that we are kind of holding an environment where that person doesn't need to think about anything other than their journey through life, how they've got to where they've got to, and where they would like to go, and how they might get there. And what part of them might need to die in order to get them there, whether it's their pride, their arrogance, their stubbornness, some of their wounds, and their sense of victimhood. All of this stuff is what we look at over the weekend. There's also a huge amount of emotional literacy and emotional catharsis work. So we look at some of the emotions that are really difficult for men. So grief, anger, sadness, shame, and provide a space for men to really explore how they deal with that emotion, how they could deal with it differently.
Can we talk about the before and after? So I'm interested to hear about how people react when you make this proposition to them, and then move on to what these weekends and this ritual does for people.
Yeah, sure. So most of our referrals come from the probation service. So we'll meet young men who've been referred by their probation officer. And it would be fair to say that there is a due degree of skepticism from the young men about anything, let alone a bunch of weird middle-aged blokes saying, we're going to take you off to the woods and help you discover what it would be to be a man. It'd be fair to say that there is a fair amount of skepticism. But what we offer them is not a kind of cognitive level invitation, but we offer them a real kind of open-hearted, soul level invitation and talk about what are some of the difficulties that perhaps we've experienced in life, some of the ways in which we've struggled to define ourselves as men, some of the struggles that we may have had letting go of childhood trauma. And that heart level connection seems to really cut through a lot of the skepticism that they feel. And some of the men report that after a kind of 1 hour conversation with two of our people doing engagement, that they feel lighter. They feel a sense of relief. And the fact that there's a group of men in society saying, we recognize that we have failed you.
Is it just a one-off weekend, Nathan, or is it more than that?
If only it was a one-off weekend, Ed. If only that worked, it would make life so much simpler. But what any of us know as men and as humans is that making real deep personal change is really hard work. And so once a man has done our weekend, he then enters into a 12-week long intensive mentoring cycle. And what that looks like is that he has a mentor who's drawn from his local community. All of the men of our community attend a weekly meeting. And at that meeting, the whole group gathers, and that can be up to 30, 35 men on some weeks. And that's a space to explore things such as, how do we deal with conflict in a way that is productive? How do we exploring different themes such as intimate relationships, sexuality, money, how to deal with our own inner saboteur. And so that's a 12-week long program. And at the end of that, there is a big celebration. And after that, they are with us for life. We do not want to manage part of our community. He's part of our community.
And how many people have been through the program, Nathan?
So as of now, we've had 295 young men that we've worked with.
And where does it go next?
So we started in Brighton around about 10 years ago, and we then received quite a lot of demand from other locations within the UK saying, we really want to bring this here. And so since 10 years ago, starting in Brighton, we're now in Crawley, Eastbourne, Hastings, Cornwall, Oxford, Leamington, Bristol, and several communities in London.
And so anyone listening to this who wants to do it themselves could get in touch with you, could they?
Absolutely. Contact us via the website, get involved, and see what might be possible in your area. One challenge and one caveat that I would just put on that is that we are currently struggling to work out, given austerity, given cuts, quite where sustainable funding for this type of intervention comes from. And that's a huge challenge for us at the moment.
And what's the impact been on reoffending of the 295 who've been through?
Yeah, our last survey, we kind of do a longitudinal survey of periodically tracking down all of the men who've been through our program to measure over time what's the impact. And the last survey that we carried out found an 80% reduction in severity and frequency of offending, or else complete cessation.
And Nathan Roberts, thank you so much. Those weekends sound fascinating. I think I'm looking at Ed's face and I think you want to do it.
Well, I was actually about to say, am I going to send you on one?
I think we should send you on one. It would have a higher impact.
Do you think?
You are both extraordinarily welcome, and we would love to see you on a weekend sometime soon.
I don't have to kill a stuffed lion, do I?
There's none of that.
Okay. No lion killing.
No. Turn up, put your mobile phone in a bag and see what happens.
I mean, that's going to be hard for
Jeff. That is terrifying, yeah.
That, he finds that terrifying on its own. Nathan, that was brilliant. Thank you so much. So what did you think?
I very much enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed all three guests very much indeed. I think it's a difficult thing to talk about because there will be people who listen to that and say, yes, but toxic masculinity still
is
has the toxicity.
Thing. Yeah.
In it, but as Ben said, you know, you've got to be able to have these conversations simultaneously. And it's good that we're having them and not leaving them to the Piers Morgans of this world.
It feels like it's a sort of beginning of a conversation, doesn't it? I mean, it's not like, it's different from some of the other episodes we've done. And it's not, we're not saying, here's
it's the fix.
A policy idea, a fix. This is all around us. This is sort of in the culture. Different cultures are different and have this to a sort of, you know, have these kind of issues facing men in particular to a greater or lesser extent. But I definitely felt listening to the conversation and having the conversation that it's right for us to engage with this. And actually, some of the things that Ben and Nathan's organizations are doing are really, really interesting. You know, taking people, you know, the fact that the probation service is referring people to Nathan, you know, and he did say to us actually after we finished recording that the privatization of some parts of the probation service is kind of has been quite problematic. But the fact that they're referring, it does, and the fingers on reoffending do show that this is really, really important stuff. And it's precisely because of the effects of toxic masculinity, or whatever you want to call it, on our society, and in particular on women in our society, that we've got to have this conversation.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Oh, we're in the outro.
Oh, we're in the outro.
We should mention that our first live show of 2020 on the 12th of March at King's Place in London, it was sold out, but I never quite understand how this happens. They've now managed to release some more tickets. So if you tried to buy tickets to come along and see the show, but you weren't able to, you should be able to now. There is a link on how to find those tickets in the description of this episode.
Talking of selling out...
Oh, I can see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
I should mention that my wife is performing at the Soho Theatre in London.
Definitely.
From the 9th to the 21st of March with her five show...
Enemies
five,
Closer.
Yeah, five-star show from last year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's called Enemies Closer. It's very funny.
Enemies Closer.
What was the sequel?
Yeah.
You went last year. It was a different show last year.
For Worse.
It was called For Worse.
Yes. She's got a good title. She's got a little thing on these titles.
I know. But now she's feeling beholden to doing it for Edinburgh show this year, and she's not quite got there with the title.
I'm sure
yet.
I'll get there.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly the kind of thing I'm good at.
Yeah, you've got a bit between your teeth.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's bawdy in parts.
Between your teeth. No.
The bit. it was last year's show was quite bawdy in parts. I was worried about Ed's innocent mind being corrupted, but you enjoyed
it. Was quite bawdy, actually.
Yeah, but you enjoyed it, didn't you?
I was a gog. is it more bawdy or less bawdy?
I'd say it's marginally less bawdy.
Right.
Yes, but it's you know, there's still plenty there for the fans of bawdiness too. And yes, it is, you know, her marriage, I think, is featured, but it's about life. Friendship. I don't know why I'm doing that.
I'm definitely going to try and go. I'm like really into going. I'm not just saying this because it's Sarah, but honestly, she's incredibly funny and she's got incredible poise and style.
She's trained as a dancer. That's where that poise comes from.
Yeah. I mean, she's almost got as much poise and style as you.
Can you think of anybody with less poise than me?
Me. Right. Shall we do our. Thank you kindly.
Yes.
I'd like to thank our guests, Iman Amrani, Ben Hurst, and Nathan Roberts.
Emma Caution produces our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pearce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made the idents, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole. He's been Amanda Chairleg.
He's been Jonathan Pillowcase.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.